just like me. They long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time
you walk? The original sweetheart of AM radio. This is Soundcheck. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta, sitting in for John Schaefer. Today, the brief but influential life of Karen Carpenter, and later, a live set of new songs from acclaimed indie rockers, The Walkmen. 40 years ago, this month, this song by The Carpenters became a number one single. It was the beginning of a string of hits by the brother-sister duo that would make them one of the biggest selling acts of the 1970s. But by the early 1980s, their success story had turned tragic. The world looked on as Karen Carpenter succumbed to an eating disorder that ultimately turned fatal. With us to help re-examine her life and career is Randy Schmidt, author of the new biography, Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. He joins us from the studios of KERA in Dallas. Randy, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Great to visit with you.
Well, the first and foremost question I think on all of our minds is, why another Karen Carpenter book, or why another kind of biographical look at Karen Carpenter? There have been so many done over the years. What's new in your book?
What's different about this book is that this is the first time that we've seen an unauthorized look at Karen's life. Every other account of her life has been something that's been, you know, from the Carpenter family or from Richard Carpenter himself. There was an authorized biography that came out in 1994. Several years before that was the highly acclaimed television movie, The Karen Carpenter Story, on CBS. But all of those were with the family's cooperation, and we really got kind of a sanitized version of her story.
And why do you think that the family was so protective of her image? Is that, I guess that would be the way to think about it.
Definitely. I think that there was they were very selective about the people that they chose to tell the stories, and some of those who were closest to Karen were never interviewed, or their opinions and their memories were never validated by, you know, being a part of these previous efforts.
So was her family kind of filtering those people that could contribute to these efforts? Did they have some kind of production control over them?
Usually,
at the books or the programs?
Yeah, usually with anything that Richard Carpenter is involved in, he does have editorial control over the final product if he participates, and that goes with most documentaries and things like that at this point. And, you know, the people who we've really never got to hear from are those close friends of Karen's. And they were the people that came forward in this book and said, you know, there's more to the story. We want justice done to Karen's story, and we want to help you. And luckily that close circle of girlfriends came forward right at the end and wanted to be a part of the project.
So what did they tell you?
Well, you know, there are a couple of ladies in particular that were Karen's friends on a day-to-day, close, best friend kind of basis. And you know, there was a lot going on with the Carpenter family dynamics and things that, you know, both Karen and Richard felt were very normal because it had been that way, you know, since they were little kids. But people on the outside were able to look at that a little bit differently. You know, from the time Karen was a little girl, her mother's plan for the family was that Richard was going to be this musical superstar. And at the time, you know, he was kind of thought to be like an up-and-coming Liberace, you know, a performing kind of showy pianist. And Karen was just kind of his tag-along. There was no interest really in music, and she just did it, you know, because Richard liked it. She listened to the albums and things that he did. And when she got into high school, she became interested in, you know, drumming, and then later after that, singing. But she still wasn't taken real seriously. Within the family, and especially from the mother, she was always considered to be Richard's backup. And what the friend said is, you know, Karen was really kind of okay with that, which is unfortunate.
Well, given all that, how did she become the front man, if you will, the front woman singing? How did that happen? How did that transition happen?
You know, when the Carpenters first came onto the scene, she was drumming and singing at the same time. And there was really no focal point. The reviewers and people who were coming and seeing the shows were saying, you know, where is this voice coming from? She had this like battery of drums surrounding her, and you could see just the top of her head and see the bangs and the hands flying around. And you know, they said, we need a front for this group. We need somebody to step out front. And Karen naturally was the one that they looked to. She was the voice, and she also had the personality.
And I'm curious, two things. Why is the book called Little Girl Blue? What's that coming from?
Well, of course, there's the song, the Rodgers and Hart song, Little Girl Blue, which is now considered to be a jazz standard. And it's something that the Carpenters recorded in the late 1970s for one of their television specials. But, you know, the meaning goes a little deeper. A lot of the people that I was visiting with, the words little girl kept coming around in these interviews I was doing. And people were saying she remained childlike. She never got to, you know, become independent and spread her wings and become a woman. And she always remained like a little girl. And that just kept coming back to me. So that was kind of obvious after visiting with her close friends. And, of course, the blue part having to do with a lot of the struggles and things that she did face in her life.
We should hear a little bit of one of her big songs, and I think your favorite superstar. Here's the Carpenters.
But you're not really. It's just the radio.
Superstar from the Carpenters. Listeners, we want to hear from you, too. Are you a fan of Karen Carpenter? What do you think of her life story? You can leave a comment on the SoundCheck page at wnyc.org/soundcheck. And please do that so we can hear from you. Randy, we're talking with Randy Schmidt. He's the author of a new book on Karen Carpenter, Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. And Randy, you know, most people know how Karen died, but a lot of people probably don't have the depth of the insight that you have. What happened? Why? Why did this tragedy occur?
By the mid-1970s, Karen, she was dieting, and that was kind of usual for her. But around that time, people were starting to realize that it was going further than just normal dieting. And she was starting to show quite a bit of signs of exhaustion and frailty. And for the first time in 1975, they had to start canceling Carpenter's concerts. They actually canceled a European and Japanese tour, or actually both tours that summer. And that was the first real heads up that something could be going wrong. And most of the people, especially within her family, felt that it was stubborn dieting, that it was just the answer to this was that she needed to eat and that she was just being stubborn because, you know, she wanted to diet and look better on stage. And, people pointed to the pressures of the business, but really nobody seemed to be looking at what might be going on inside. And it's probably because of the time that we're looking at. You know, 1975 through 1980, we're talking about a time that eating disorders were not very well known. And those people who were experts in the field hadn't been experts for more than just a few years. And most people didn't really know what they were dealing with in this matter. So
did she have an awareness of her illness, or was she blocking it? Did she ever seek any kind of treatment?
Over the years, she did seek out to some other individuals who she heard about with, you know, similar struggles. So even though she wasn't admitting it to those around her, and maybe not even to herself, she was still interested in it. And, you know, she contacted Pat Boone's daughter, Cherry Boone, and she's now known as Cherry Boone O'Neill. She's written several books about her struggles with eating disorders. And Karen contacted her and, you know, wanted advice. Basically, she told her, you know, I need a quick fix. I need to get back on the road. I need to, you know, be in the studio, and what can I do to get rid of this the fastest? You know, like it was something that could just be cured. And so she was seeking some help in those ways. She was also reading books. She read a book called The Best Little Girl in the World by Stephen Levenkron. And because of his having written that book, she wanted to go and seek therapy with him once she finally did come to the stage where she was ready to admit that there was a problem, and which was around 1981.
And so she was still able to record at this time, or was she?
Yeah,
she
was still recording, and she was still doing some public appearances and things. But, you know, I think she wanted to get some people off her back. People were saying, you know, Karen, you're too thin. You need to address this problem. And she wanted to get that behind her and move on. But I don't think she ever, you know, fully committed 100% like it would have taken.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear some music from the last session recorded from the Carpenters. This is from 1982. It's called Now.
Now when I'm smiling, I know why. You light up my world like the morning sun. You're so deep within me, we're almost one. And now all the fears that I had start to fade. I was always afraid of
music from the Carpenters from their last session recorded in 1982. I'm Jacqueline Sincotta in for John Schaefer today, and we're talking with Randy Schmidt, who just wrote a book, Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. And Randy, I'm interested to hear some more of your comments, because reading the book, some more about her relationship with her family. It seems like she had a very difficult relationship with her mother in particular, and how did that impact some of what was going on in her life?
You know, I was saying earlier that that she was kind of considered to be backup to Richard. So I think that was something that was really difficult, you know, over the years. He was the one that was getting most of the attention and credit, at least within the family, for the Carpenter's success. And Karen was his backup. And I think that does a lot for someone's self-esteem, and it definitely contributed to a lot of the issues that she had. There was a lot of control still placed upon Karen, even as, you know, when she was of age. She was, you know, still living at home into her mid-20s. And, you know, it's been described to me by a friend of Karen and the family that they said that, you know, with a baby, you let them crawl, but then they start to go over to one side and you say, oh, no, you can't. You've got to move back over here. Go this way. And they said they felt as though Karen never left that stage or that form of control from her mother. You know, she was constantly redirected in the way that other people wanted her to go. And from what I've heard from a lot of people who suffer from eating disorders, there is that lack of control, that feeling that, you know, somebody else is making all the decisions, and this is one way that I can have control over something.
And you're speaking about how she really didn't have too much control of her career. I think her giving up drumming was kind of part of that to kind of put her to the forefront of the band. But she was a skilled drummer since her early years. And actually, we have a clip from the Richard Carpenter Trio, which highlights her drumming. We're going to hear a little bit now. Karen Carpenter on drums from the 1966 tune called Iced Tea from the Richard Carpenter Trio, the early version of the Carpenters. We're talking with Randy Schmidt, author of Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. Randy, you're considered the go-to guy for all things Carpenters. What drew you to her or them as a subject?
When I was 13, I watched The Karen Carpenter Story, the movie that I mentioned earlier. It was a made-for-TV movie on CBS that aired in 1989, and You know, I was born in the middle of the Carpenters' heyday, and so I missed it firsthand. And I wanted to learn everything that I could, everything that I had missed. And seeing that movie prompted me to start researching. And, you know, I was in our local library the following week and clipping articles and things like that over the next few years. And it was something that I never did at that time with the intention of writing a book. And it just evolved over the years. And, you know, I wanted to learn more. I fell in love with her music and her story all at once watching that movie. So I was intrigued equally by the voice, which I'd never heard anything like before, and the story as well.
We're getting some comments on the sound check page at wnyc.org/soundcheck if you'd like to leave a comment. Tom from Toronto absolutely hated her music in the 70s and 80s while I was growing up. Now it has a cool nostalgia. And we nice. Kind of are here. We've heard that too, because there were there was the 1994 cover album that had a lot of very interesting folks like Sheryl Crow and Sonic Youth on it. So I think, yeah, there's something that became fashionable at some point about the Carpenters after being considered a really kind of square group. Were they really as square as our image of them kind of speaks to?
They were very normal, I think, in a lot of ways. I say that, but then, of course, obviously some of the things behind the scenes that we know about now were not real normal. But, I mean, they lived in Downey, California, which is a very suburban type of place, you know. And it's not, you know, they never went Hollywood. They never, they never left that Downey kind of state of mind. It's definitely a small town feeling. And But there was a Brady Bunch image attached to them, and I think a lot of that had to do with the way they were marketed and the way that they were promoted by the record company. And, you know, they were side by side smiling, these almost identical smiles in all the photographs, and just kind of too good to be true, almost a Brady Bunch kind of image.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something now that I think people can look back and just appreciate for it was what it was. But people are starting to realize that, you know, whether you love the Carpenters for their music or you love them for Karen's voice, that voice is undeniable. You know, she has one of those voices that could have been a hit in any decade. And, you know, the warmth of a Nat King Cole or, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, she's instantly identifiable. And it's just such an undeniable talent, whether you like, you know, 70s love songs or not.
And she actually did try to break out a little bit from the Carpenters with some music that she worked on with Phil Ramone that didn't get released until after her death. We want to hear a little bit of that from an album called Loveliness, a solo album. It was finally released in 1996. Karen Carpenter goes disco for sure. That's actually Love Lines, the name of that song, and some work she did with Phil Ramone in an effort to kind of break out. Would you say, Randy, why was she doing that? What was the reason?
You know, Richard was actually in a rehab treatment center at the time for an addiction to Quaaludes, which he's detailed in several accounts since that time. And she was not quite ready to settle down and take time off like he was doing. And it probably would have been a good time for her to address some of the issues that she was facing as far as her eating disorder. But, you know, she wanted to keep working, and she'd always kind of sought, I think, a little bit of, you know, acclaim for herself as a singer and as an individual artist. She was always considered, you know, one half of the Carpenters, but never did we hear of Karen Carpenter winning a Grammy or, you know, a Karen Carpenter album. And so this was her chance to kind of spread her wings and do something on her own.
Why wasn't it released while she was still alive when they made it?
you know, she was so excited about the you know, the final product, and she played it for the people on the West Coast, the East Coast, that were associated with the A&M record label, and there were celebrations, and they were toasting and cheering the coming of this great new artist as a solo artist. And the reaction on the other coast, once it was played for Herb Alpert, Jerry Moss, and also Richard was present, the response was just silence. They had no response whatsoever, and then once it was over with, they felt it was a very poor album, that it was not marketable, and basically they you know, talked her into shelving it.
How did it sell when it did come out?
It finally was released in 1996, and it wasn't a blockbuster or anything, but you know, any album that comes out 13 years, actually in this case 16 years after it was intended to be released, is not, you know, necessarily going to do as well as it might have done at that time. You know, it needs to be judged alongside the albums that similar artists were doing around that time, you know, 1979 and 1980, and not comparing it side by side with We've Only Just Begun and Close to You. You know, that wasn't the point. This was Karen pouring her heart and soul and, you know, picking the songs herself and just doing something as an artist for the first time, really, and not having it, you know, spoon-fed to her or told what to do.
And what is the legacy? What is Karen Carpenter's legacy? Where has it gone?
I think that we have moved past, you know, the whole thing with the image issues. I think people are able to now start separating the Carpenters and that cheesy, as I mentioned earlier, Brady Bunch image that they seem to be plastered with in the 1970s. People are able to step aside from that or step back and say, this was an amazing vocalist and one of the greatest voices of the, you know, the 20th century, right up there with, you know, Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald and these, you know, Judy Garland, these identifiable voices that within 2 or 3 seconds of hearing them, you know exactly who they are.
I want to thank Randy Schmidt for joining us today on Soundcheck. He's the author of Little Girl Blue, The Life of Karen Carpenter. Thanks, Randy. And we're going to go out with music from Sonic Youth. This is their version of Superstar from the 1994 cover albums, If I Were a Carpenter.
It's just the radio.
Up next, the band The Walkmen will tell us why Lisbon, Portugal inspired the title of their new album, recorded mostly in Philadelphia and Brooklyn. And tune in to Soundcheck this Friday as Soundcheck welcomes another guest host, the electronic music superstar Moby sits in for John Schaefer. Moby will talk with filmmaker Jim Jarmusch, and we'll hear a live performance from the dance rock band Neon Indian. That's this Friday, Moby on Soundcheck.
Places I had gone to never see any light. Dirty basements, dirty norms, dirty places coming through. Extreme walls alone. Did you ever like it, Pam? I would stand in line for.